We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Vanessa. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you for asking me to share. It's always a privilege when someone asks me to share my story, especially because when I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, no one wanted to hear from me. So it's always a blessing to be gifted the opportunity to share today. My sobriety date is May 21st of 99. I have a sponsor. Her name is Carol L. And I have women that I'm actively working with in the book. I have a home group, which is The Real Thing. It meets on Monday nights at the Pigeon Coop in Tempe, Arizona. So any ladies listening to this podcast, if you come through Arizona anytime, please come see us at the Pigeon Coop at 7 p.m. on Monday nights, women's meeting. And I was taught to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I really love the big book. I think that it's inspired. I think that the words that are in the book are there for a reason, and that those words are specific, right? And so, for example, you know, it talks about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I hear a lot of people say in meetings what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And it says to share what we were like. And it wasn't the problem, right? Like, it could be all sorts of different things. It's really what was going on with me and what I was struggling with, right? So I was born and raised in Hawaii. I grew up there. My mom actually got sober in 1982, and I was born in 80. So I was 2 years old when my mom got sober. So I really don't remember my mom ever being in an active addiction. What I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous were these wonderful people that were always in our house. And my mom was really, really involved in service work there. So our house was always full of women and aunties, and my stepdad was sober. And so we just were, I just thought that that was normal to be in meetings during the school week till 9 o'clock at night. And we'd go out to the diners after. And I remember, like, just to kind of give you an example of the way my mind worked as a kid, you know, I went to Catholic school in the fourth grade, and I grew up in AA, so I didn't really grow up super religious or with organized religion. And so I'd never been to Mass, and in Catholic school, you go to Mass. And so I come home from school and my mom says, "Well, how was school?" And I was like, "It was great." And she was like, "Oh, really?" And I said, "Yeah, we went to Mass," and anything to get me out of class. I thought Mass was great. I said, "Mom, did you know that they said the AA prayer there?" And she said, "Which prayer is that?" And I said, "You know, Our Father who art in heaven." And she started laughing and she goes, I think they had that before us." But that was my understanding, right? So I just thought alcoholics were great. My mom is a drug and alcohol counselor, and so I probably, having just grown up in AA and my mom's education and things like that, I probably knew a lot more about what alcoholism looks like than your typical adolescent. And so it wasn't like I ever planned on drinking, but even as a kid, in hindsight's 20/20, I was definitely the one. I have a sister who's not an alcoholic, and I definitely was the more wild one. I didn't think a lot of things through. I was really impulsive as a kid. I'd have an idea and then I would do it. So when I look back at things as a kid, I can remember my first addiction was sugar. I loved candy. I loved sugar. Like, I loved caffeine. I used to get in trouble at meetings because I would go get coffee during the meeting, and I would be like putting these pounds of of the sugar cubes. I'd be putting like 10 sugar cubes in those tiny little styrofoam coffee cups. And this old timer used to say, what are you doing? Who's that for? And I'd be like, it's for my mom. And then I'd go sneak out to the playground. And I'd be sitting on the steps drinking this coffee and he would bust me. My parents at one time tried to have me not eat any sugar and I got caught eating candy in the closet. When I was 7, I was in an Alateen meeting and the kids in there were smoking. You know, they were all older kids. I'm 7. And they said, do you smoke? And I said, yeah, I smoke. I'd never smoked in my life. And I ended up almost dying. My sister ended up telling on me. And my dad told me if I ever smoked again, he'd make me eat a pack of cigarettes. And the way my sister and my mind is different, you know, because people talk about the mind of the alcoholic is different. I didn't even think about it. Someone asked me a question and I wanted to be a part of it, and I said yes. And when my sister and I were younger, we struggled with sucking our fingers or whatever. And so my sister, being the logical one, when they asked her if she smoked or wanted to try it, my sister thought, her thought process was, it was so hard for me to stop sucking my thumb. I don't know what would happen if I started doing that. So she said, no, like she's 9 at the time. She's 2 years older than me. And I don't even think about it. Like I just do it. And that was how I was. That's just what I did. Even when it came to all of the things that I did in my addiction. So fast forward, on the outside, everything looked really normal in my life. My parents were together. They both worked outside of the home. The first time in my life that I can ever really remember feeling kind of like my world got spun, when I was almost 12, we left Hawaii and moved to the mainland. It was different because culturally, growing up in Hawaii, I'm Haole, so I'm white, and most of my friends were local, either Asian or Hawaiian. And so even though I looked different than most of my friends on the island, culturally, I was local, Haole. And so when I came to Arizona, where my mom is from, for the first time around, it was around a lot of people who looked like me, but culturally I was different and I sounded different. I used to have a thicker pidgin accent, and so I felt different. And my parents had also gone through a divorce, my stepdad and my mom at that time. And so they ended up getting back together during that first year that we moved back to Arizona. But it was the first time that I just felt unsettled and I felt different. Fast forward, high school, and I still had never drank because my friends were starting to drink, but I knew that I was predispositioned for it. And I was pretty popular in high school. I was in student council, so I was the vice president of my class. I was an athlete, so I ran with a pretty popular group of kids. And hindsight, no one really ever pressured me. My friends didn't seem to care that I didn't drink, but I always felt if I drank, I'd be cooler, right? And so the first time I drank was at a wedding. A friend of mine, we were invited to a friend's wedding with a friend of mine. So my mom wasn't there. We were there with her mom and they had a champagne fountain and the mom had said that we could drink if we wanted to. And so I don't know why I decided that that was going to be the day that I drank, but that's what I did. And so I had all of this knowledge about what an alcoholic looks like and my family. And so my thought was that I'm going to drink and I'm going to watch for all of these things that I've been told happen to people who are alcoholics, right? So if you drink to get drunk, you might be an alcoholic. If you drink in the morning, you're an alcoholic. If you black out, you could be an alcoholic. All these things. But I also thought that the reason why my mom couldn't drink alcohol was because she had done drugs. So I thought, if I don't do drugs, I will be fine, right? I'll be able to manage this and I'll be successful where the rest of my family has failed. Now, what I forgot to mention is that I have addiction on both sides of my family and recovery on both sides. And so on my mom's side, my mom's sober. So my mom is now 41. She just celebrated 41 years sober. My grandmother, so my maternal grandmother, who passed 7 years ago, but when she passed, I believe she was 42 years sober. And that's on my mom's side. And then on my biological dad's side, my dad was sober for a long time. And then my great uncle, so his uncle, and then my great uncle's grandfather, so my great grandfather, were all sober. My grandfather died with, my great grandfather died with like 25 years sober, something like that. And then my great uncle, he's still alive. He's still sober. He's over 40 years sober. So I think he's 46 or 47 years sober now. And then my dad and I don't really talk anymore, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. So anyways, I'm predispositioned for it. And so I know all of this stuff about drinking. So I start drinking at this wedding and I remember I had 6 glasses of champagne. And to be honest with you, I definitely got a buzz from it, but I wasn't belligerently drunk, but I felt a part of, right? I felt like I was a part of with my girlfriends that were drinking. And what it did for me is I had this brain that always told me that I wasn't cool enough, that I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't smart enough, that at any minute these people were going to stop being my friend. And when I drink, those voices go away. And so I loved it. And none of those bad things happened that I thought would happen that first time I drank. So fast forward, drinking all through high school. And I think that when you're a young person, especially a young person in AA, it can be tough sometimes because all young people, I don't think most young people drink responsibly. Culturally in America, we just don't teach that. And not that I necessarily would have had anything to do with learning, right? But everybody kind of looks like that. And so I didn't think too much about it. In high school, most of my friends, when they drank, they got really drunk. And so I just thought I was like everybody else. And I didn't do drugs. I really only drank. But what I will say about the way that I drank is that I could always drink more than everybody else. And I never wanted it to end. I loved drinking. And I loved the peace and quiet that it gave me. And it made it so that I didn't care. And fast forward, you know, so there were some things that kind of, once I started drinking, started to change in high school. So for example, when I was a freshman and sophomore year, I was a varsity athlete. I was a runner. And when I started drinking, I kind of went to the other side of the spectrum of things. So I started smoking cigarettes. And I quit running. So I quit doing my athlete stuff, but I was still vice president of my class and still involved with school and doing decent. My junior year of high school, I really started missing a lot of classes. I started ditching a lot. I did get through high school. My senior year of high school, and this was a huge, you know, and when I typically share in meetings, I share in a very general way. But I think sometimes there are significant things that happen that probably propel our addiction or can sometimes be the reason that maybe things got worse faster, right? So my senior year of high school, the beginning of my fall semester, my dad at the time, so my stepdad that had raised me, the one that was sober with my mom as a kid, his name was Chuck. He tells us that he's been diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's disease and that it's terminal and that he's going to die. And so my senior year of high school, I think that my dad is dying. And my mom is not really around a lot. And I'm just like watching my dad kind of melt away. He had been in the Navy when I was a kid. He was this very joyful, playful guy when we were a kid. And then now he was just kind of wasting away and on the computer all the time. And there was, he just always seemed like just really sick and not really very present anymore. And it had kind of been like that for a while. But my senior year of high school, when I thought that he was dying, it just seemed a lot more. So at the end of my senior year of high school, my dad all of a sudden doesn't have cancer anymore. And there had been a lot that had gone on that year between him and my mom. And in the city of Mesa here in Arizona had donated thousands of dollars in sick days to my dad, who they thought was dying from Hodgkin's disease. And he had shaved his entire body because the doctor had told him it'd be better for him to shave everything than to watch his hair fall out. My mom had picked him up from waiting rooms from where he'd had his radiation and chemo, and he looked really sick, and we'd change bandages from bone marrow draws and things like that. And long story short, through a series of events, my mom had discovered that he never had had cancer, and that it had been a way for him to try to keep my mom from leaving him, because my mom had asked for a divorce at the beginning of the year that we didn't know about. And a month later, this came up, and he had asked my mom to stay until he, you know, to help care for him. And my mom, wanting to do the right thing, had stayed, not knowing that my dad at the time had created this whole thing. And what had actually happened is my dad had relapsed, and he had relapsed probably years prior, but had been hiding it. Under the guise of having cancer, he then could use the way that he wanted to. And so we had been living in a home with active addiction, and I was drinking at the time. And my senior year of high school, I would say, is really where my drinking really started to become something that I wanted to do all of the time. I wasn't drinking during the week at school, but every weekend, that's what I wanted to do. Friday, Saturday night, I wanted to drink. And if we couldn't get alcohol, it was not a good time. Whereas, like, I remember a girlfriend saying to me after I got sober that she noticed that I would do that, that if we couldn't get alcohol, everybody else in the group was like, all right, well, let's go do something else. And I would just be like, the night sucks, and would be just not in a good mood about it. So I graduate from high school, and my biological dad lives in Hawaii. He's sober at this time. So me and my best friend from high school and my sister, we go back to Hawaii, and my mom deals with the tornado of what's going on with what my stepdad did. So I'm in Hawaii. I'm living with my biological dad, who I've spent lots of summers with, but I had never I'd never lived with my dad other than 2 months in the summer. My dad and I have always butted heads. I really struggled and continue to in my relationship with my father. And so I just really did whatever I wanted. I had no respect for him or his sobriety. If he was out, I had alcohol in the house. I had alcohol in my room. I got a fake ID. I could drink whenever I wanted. I'm 18 years old, and I'm blonde and small and cute and all those things. And Oahu is mainly military, and so I could pretty much go out with absolutely no money and get good and hammered in any bar I wanted to go into. And so there was a lot of that. And I was enrolled in school. So to give you an example, my first semester, I was in hula, ceramics. I had a math class that I was in with my sister that I would sometimes make it to because it was early. And I think philosophy or something like that. I got a C in ceramics, or no, I got a C in hula that semester, and I got a D in ceramics. And I don't know that I passed the math class. I was really off to the races. So I was enrolled in school, but not really going very much. But I did hide behind that. I worked at a pizzeria in Waikiki, and I just drank all the time. I would say I occasionally had blackouts in high school, but now my blackouts were very, very often. Almost every time I drank, I was blacking out. And the amounts of alcohol that I was drinking for how young I was and the age, you know, it was a lot. And so I really was drinking almost daily. At the end of that year, I could get about 4 days without drinking. And hindsight's 20/20, right? Like, I didn't know what withdrawal symptoms looked like. And see, you know, I wouldn't do certain things because alcoholics do those things. And I was really still trying. I did not want to be an alcoholic. So I was really trying these things to manage it. And so I wouldn't drink in the morning, even though I was really hungover. I'll really drink whatever I can get my hands on. But if I have my preference, I liked to drink Cafe Zinfandel. So it would be like these 1.5 liters of Cafe Zinfandel. And it was like $6 back then. I looked it up recently. It was like $8, I think, now at Walmart. So inflation, $2 more in 24 years or 25 years. I would drink Ernest Julio Gallo Cafe Zinfandel. 1.5 liters or rum, vodka. Like I wasn't really a beer drinker, so it was either wine or liquor, and I would sleep as late as I could because it was okay to go to the beach and start drinking at like 1 or 2. So I would sleep till like 11 or noon, and then I could drink within an hour of getting up. And then if I didn't have to work that day at the pizzeria, I would drink the rest of the day, and then I would show up to work super hungover if I was working in the morning, and I would have the money. I would have no gas in my car, so they would give me the money, which was meant for if someone needed cash, like to pay for their pizza, like needed change. They would give me the change money, and I would put that in my gas tank and hope that they didn't need change. And then also hope that I would make enough in tips to cover the change money. So it was just this unmanageability. I would write a check Saturday night because you could write paper checks back then. So I would write a check Saturday night because I'd be out of money for my $6 bottle of wine and try to beat it to the bank on Monday. You know, like just this unmanageability. I blacked out in Waikiki one night, came out of a blackout smoking weed, right? So now I've smoked weed, and it was all of these lines I said I wasn't going to do, I started crossing. I just kept, okay, well, I'll draw this line in the sand and I won't do that. And then I would do that. And I kept lowering these expectations of myself to meet me where I was at. My husband says all the time, you know, in the beginning, it was this huge reward for a very small consequence. And in the end, it was this huge consequence and a very small reward. I wasn't getting the peace of mind anymore. I was drinking so much that I would make myself sick so that I could drink more because it wasn't enough anymore. I wasn't getting that relief. My mind was constantly attacking me. I just was so sad. I just felt so disconnected from everyone. It would be like, you know, in the beginning, I was the life of the party. And in the end, I was the girl crying in the corner. Just never knew what you were going to get. So I think Hawaii's the reason I'm out of control. If I go back to Arizona and I'm with my friends from high school, I can get it back together and I can recapture those old days, right? Like kind of that thought that Bill had when Abby came to visit him. Like if I can go back to that, I can be good again. So I come back to Arizona and, you know, everywhere you go, there you are. So I'm doing the same thing, but now I'm drinking way more than my friends from high school and they don't think it's cute. And the last night that I drank, you know, had you told me that I was coming back to Arizona to get sober, I probably would not have came. And not because I didn't think that I needed to get sober, not because I didn't believe in AA or anything like that. It was that I thought I knew this stuff. I thought that I knew all of this about AA, and it didn't help me not become an alcoholic. And I also just, I really didn't think that I could stop drinking. I thought that it would be better to just keep doing that than give my mom any hope that I could get sober, because I just didn't think that it was possible for me. So I come back to Arizona, I go to this graduation party and it was all more of the same stuff, but there were a few things that I remember about that night. And one was I came out, my sister was with me. I came out of a blackout to my sister telling me that she hated me like that. And I went back into the blackout. And then in the morning, my sister's mad at me. She's not talking to me. My mom drives out from Phoenix to pick us up. I'm super hungover. We're driving back into Phoenix. And I don't know why I said this, right? But a friend of mine says that a moment of clarity is when God stops the lies long enough for us to see the truth. And my mom would occasionally ask me, how's your drinking going? And I would say, it's great, Mom. I'm totally normal. And I can take it or leave it. And then people in meetings would ask, oh, how are the girls doing? And my mom would say, well, Lara's doing great, but I'm saving a seat for Ness. And I thought my mom didn't know. I thought that I hit it really well. My mom says to me when I got in the car, Ness, do you think you might be an alcoholic? And I said, Mom, I know I am. And I don't remember any more of the conversation. I don't know what else she said, but I just remember like being honest about it. And I knew if I told my mom, right, like she's this active alcohol, you know, an AA, she's a drug and alcohol counselor. Like the fear was, if my mom knew, I'm not going to be able to hide it anymore. And she's not going to let me drink and that kind of stuff. And I just didn't know how to not drink. So fast forward, 4 days later, my sister has always made friends with people in the program. She's a good Al-Anon. And so she had made friends with these boys that were sober at the time. And my friends lived on the other side of town weren't really happy with me. And so I wasn't hanging out with anyone. I didn't have any plans. And my sister invited me to go to a meeting with these guys. And I would sometimes go to meetings with my mom and stuff like that, looking for boys. Right. And so I was like, sure, it's attraction rather than promotion. These boys are cute. So I was like, cool, I'll go to the meeting. So I go to the meeting and I had no intention of getting sober that day. I really didn't. I wasn't ever planning on going to AA. I just hadn't drank in 4 days. And what ended up happening is the power of the program, right? Like it was a young person that happened to be speaking that night. And he was talking about how when he came into the rooms, he wore a baseball hat and a pair of sunglasses because he didn't want people to look at him and know. Right. And I related to that. I remember they started doing the chips and the girl that did the chips, she said that the 24-hour chip was just a desire to not drink or use that day. And I got up and I went and got a chip and my sister was like, what the, like, there was like no plan. It wasn't like my sister was trying to get me to get sober or anything like that. My sister was shocked. I was shocked. And I went up and I got the chip and after the meeting, this girl came up to me and she was young and she was pretty and she was interested in me and she wanted to be my friend. She gave me her phone number. She asked me if I had a sponsor and I'm a liar. So I was like, yeah, I have a sponsor. I did not have a sponsor. I just picked up a 24-hour chip. And she was like, well, where is she? And I said, she's in Kansas. And she said, oh, okay. Well, do you know when she's coming back? And I was like, no. She said, well, why don't I temporarily sponsor you until she comes back? And her name was Zoe. And Zoe was my sponsor consistently for a good 13 years. And I'm so grateful for her. You know, she was 3 years sober at the time. She was 21. I was 18. And she really taught me about how we do life sober and how we do it as young women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she took me through all 12 steps in about 90 days. around 90 days, I started trying to sponsor other people and be of service. My mom ended up getting remarried to this wonderful man. He was just really, you know, he filled a void in my life because I didn't really have a dad anymore. And he was really good to us, and he welcomed us into his home, and he was sober also. And he really, really supported me in my first couple of years sober. He helped pay for me to get through college, and he let me live there. Him and my mom let me live there for my first 2 years sober. My first year, I was really struggled, and it was hard to do life without drinking. Everything I did from, you know, really 15 to 18, I had been drinking. And so the idea of, you know, doing life without alcohol gave me a lot of anxiety. I felt in a lot of ways my first year that I was more functional drinking than I was sober. I passed all my classes that might have been D's and stuff like that when I was drinking. But when I got sober, I would be in the middle of trying to go to school and I would have anxiety and I would just leave and go to a meeting. And so I actually failed a couple of classes my first semester. I got fired from a job my first year of sobriety. I just had a really hard time showing up for anything but AA. And my mom would say to me, Ness, just keep putting God in AA first and everything will take care of itself. And I believed her. You know, I believed the people that told me that in the rooms and that had walked before me. And slowly but surely, I started to get things together, you know. So at 2 years sober, I ended up getting a job as a nanny. And I worked for a pretty wealthy family in the Phoenix area. They trusted me in their home with their daughter. They provided me with a lot of opportunity. The mom was just this very brilliant lawyer, and she was so impressive. And I learned a lot from her. I remember calling Zoe when I was getting ready to transfer from the community college to the 4-year. And I was scared. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to do it. I was worried that I wasn't smart enough. All of those thoughts, right? And I called Zoe and I was almost 3 years sober. And I called Zoe and I was telling her what I was worried about. And Zoe said, Ness, you're going to do it the same way that you've stayed sober. You're going to take one class at a time and you're going to write one paper at a time. And you're going to do it. And I was like, okay, like, you know, when I first came in, the idea of never drinking again was so overwhelming. And they would tell me, just do it one day at a time, one meeting at a time, don't drink in between meetings, you know? And so I took that concept and I applied it to everything in my life, right? Like the tools that we learn in AA are not things that just help us with our drinking, but they solve all of our problems. I went to college and I ended up graduating with my undergrad, and this was like 2003, and there was I was watching a lot of Sex in the City, and I'd never lived anywhere that wasn't warm. Arizona and Hawaii is where I grew up, so I wanted to move to New York City. I'd never even been there. I had a friend that I had met at a Wacky Pond, Montana. We had stayed in touch. And so I ended up moving to New York. I took a job as a nanny out there and I moved to New York City and I was there for 2 years. So when I was 5 and 6 years sober, and it was awesome. You know, I moved there and I knew one person in AA. And by the time I left, I had a whole fellowship, right? But when I first moved there, and I share this with people, because I think sometimes, you know, we get these beautiful lives that AA gives us and we get to experience all of these things. And it would have been very easy for me to move there and just not be a part of, or just drift into finding other people and things like that. And when I first got there, you know, when I was in Arizona right before I turned 5 years sober, I was sponsoring like 8 girls. I was chairing the Friday Night Young People's meeting with Anthony. I was just really in the middle of AA. And then when I moved to New York, nobody really knows me but this one other girl, right? Nobody's asked me to sponsor him. No one's asking me to speak in meetings. So I had to do the same thing that I did when I came in. I had to act like a newcomer. I had to ask women for their phone number. I had to pick up that 5,000-pound phone. I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I had to raise my hand and tell people that I was new and that I needed friends. I had to be willing to be uncomfortable until it became comfortable again. And I think sometimes what happens for us when we have some time sober is that when we come in, we're desperate and people see that desperation. So they're quick to help us, right? If you're in a community of responsible AA members. But once we have a little bit of time sober, if we don't act like a newcomer, a lot of times I think that we think like, oh, okay, they're fine. They probably have their friends, things along those lines. And so I had to make it a point to let people know I needed you. And I'm so grateful that I did that. And some of those friendships, I've been friends with some of those people for over 20 years since having come back to Arizona. So I'm there 2 years. It was a wonderful time. I come back from New York. I'm in Arizona. I take a job at the University of Phoenix. I go back to school. I complete a master's degree in an MBA in marketing. I buy a home. I get a dog. I'm living with sober girlfriends or renting the extra room in my house. And I'm just really loving life, right? Like I'm doing really, really well in my career. I'm just having a ton of fun. I'm traveling. I'm going to all the YPAWs, all the ICKYPAWs, the WACKYPAWs, the ACKYPAWs. I have friends all over the country and just really having a lot of fun. During this time, I'd done a ton of work. I'd gone through the steps numerous times. I'm working with other women. And really, the only area of my life that I struggled with was relationships. You know, I really had a hard time with being trusting God in romantic relationships. And so if I was dating a guy and he told me that he loved me, he wanted me to meet his parents, he tried to come to my home group at the time, any of that kind of stuff, I would break it off. So if you were a friend of mine, if you were a guy and you were my friend, I would never date you. And if I dated you, you would never be my friend. So I really separated that partnership. If you dated me, it was not a true partnership. I was very guarded and you really didn't get to see, you didn't get to see my life. You didn't get to be a part of it. And I was like compartmentalizing all that, right? So I started really doing a lot of work around that, probably around 6 years sober, really kind of trying to get into my fear of true partnership and things along those lines and trying to get to a place where I was open to allowing someone in. Because growing up, all of the men in my life had left. My stepdad left. My biological dad wasn't around the way that I would have liked him to be. I had seen a lot of divorce and I wanted to believe in that idea and that principle, but I just really didn't think that it was something that I was capable of. So fast forward, I had gone to ICKYPAW in Atlanta. This was 2009, May of 2009. And I have celebrated 10 years sober there. Prior to this experience, my longest relationship was 4 months. And I go to the conference and I run into an old, there was a group of friends of ours that we always hung out with from typically like New York and the Boston area and some from LA. And there was a group of us that all hung out together. And there was a guy there that I knew, but I hadn't seen in a while. And his name was Dwayne. And we started hanging out that weekend. And it was supposed to be a weekend thing. And, you know, I've come home from ICKYPAW. And he sends me an email and he says, you know, I respect you saying that you didn't want a long distance thing, that it's just a weekend thing, but I'd like to come visit you. And so he comes to visit. And then 2 weeks later, I go to Boston to visit him. And then 2 weeks later, he comes to Arizona. So now I'm in this like long distance relationship that I'd said that I didn't want to be in. And I say to him, well, you know, if we're going to keep seeing each other, you need to be willing to move to Arizona. And he says yes, which I wasn't expecting. And so at the end, so we started dating in May, and at the end of September, he moves to Arizona and he runs a guest house from a friend of ours, Colin and Stephanie. And it allows us to date in the same place and actually be in each other's lives day in, day out, right? Because all my relationships before, I didn't let them into that nitty gritty part. I didn't let them see what it was like when I'd had a long day at work. I just was very, there was this idea that if you knew all of me, you wouldn't love me. And so this was really the first true partnership that I had where I really let someone into that part of my life, and he did too, you know, and I remember it was really uncomfortable for me because I was scared. And so I did what AA taught me, which was I would ask God to just help me to stay where my feet were and to trust that God would help keep my heart open. And, you know, if it was God's will, that he would guide me in that. And there was a lot of prayer. And, you know, after a little over a year of dating, Dwayne and I got engaged. 9 months later, we had a really big AA wedding, and that was March of 2011. We ended up moving back to Massachusetts. We were in Massachusetts for 3 years. And when we moved there, I did the same thing that I did in New York. I really got involved. I created a fellowship of women that I absolutely love and still talk to on a regular basis now. At that time, we started trying to have a baby, and I'd been really responsible when I was younger. So I had just thought, we're going to start trying and we'll have a baby. Like, you know, and up to this point in my life, there had never been anything that I had not been able to work hard and achieve, right? Like anything I wanted to move to New York. I did it. I wanted my condo. I bought it. I wanted the director position at work. I worked my butt off. I got it. There wasn't anything that I hadn't dreamed of in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had not been able to achieve up till that point. So we start trying to have a baby, and it's not happening, right? We're not getting pregnant. Probably after about a year trying, we start going through the infertility process, and there were some things coming back with me that were making it difficult for us to have a baby. And I really started to struggle. And during this time, literally every single girl I sponsor has gotten pregnant. My sponsor Zoe has gotten pregnant. I am really struggling with trying to be happy for my friends, but also can't help but be sad for myself. It's a really, you know, infertility is so difficult. It's such a hard place because it's like this club that you never wanted to be a part of, and people don't really know what to do or how to talk to you about it, you know, and they offer all sorts of advice, and you're like, yep, thank you. Like, just relax and it'll happen. Or my friend did this or, but you know, it's just, and then as a woman, I felt so inadequate because this was something that I was supposed to be able to do and something I've always wanted. And so we end up, after 2 years of trying in Massachusetts, we move back to Arizona. We buy a 6-bedroom home and we keep trying for another year. What had happened during those 3 years is that I had gotten really resentful at this God that I had, that I was doing all of the right things and wasn't getting pregnant. And so slowly but surely, I had actually stopped praying and I didn't even realize I had done that. I was still sponsoring and going to meetings, but I also wasn't really sharing too much about what was going on because it was so painful. I didn't want to talk about it and nobody wants to hear about that. It's just there, you feel so powerless and there's nothing anyone can do. It's just a really lonely, difficult place to be. And so I had unbeknownst to me, really started to block myself off from the sunlight of the spirit. I was very resentful. My husband and I were in a really difficult place, and he suggested that we go to marriage counseling. And I'm so grateful he did. You know, having been raised by someone who is a counselor, I had never done counseling. So I was a little resistant to it, but we ended up going to marriage counseling. And this woman, Linda, really, really helped us to hear one another. And she is also a member of the fellowship. And so she suggested that I get a local sponsor because my sponsor didn't live in the States anymore. She was in Singapore, and I really was, you know, she'd had her baby and I wasn't talking to her very often. And so I agreed that I probably should go through the steps again. And so I was walking into a women's meeting and I happened to run into a friend that I've always loved from my old home group, 48, and Gina. Her name is Gina, and Gina was walking out of the meeting and I was walking in. And she stopped to give me a hug. And it was, again, one of those experiences where, like, I had no intention of asking Gina to take me through the steps that day, but that's what ended up happening. And I will tell you that the steps are designed to help you create a relationship with the God of your understanding, right? And so I did the work again. Gina had me write the set-aside prayer on the inside cover of my big book. And I got a new big book. And she was like, I want you to have a completely new experience. And so we went through the steps again. I was 16 years sober at the time. As we went through it, I have read that book over 100 times, I'm sure, at this point. I've had so many experiences. I know that book. I can quote it. And we're reading the chapter to the agnostic, and it's talking about not being able to step from bridge to shore because I've been leaning on the God of reason. And in that moment, I realized that the God that I had was this like Santa Claus God or this God of reason, right? If I could understand why I couldn't have a baby, then I could accept it and move on. And in that moment, I realized that my God was too small, that there are going to be things in this world that I don't get, that I don't understand, and that if I have to understand them, we have a problem, and that my God has to be bigger. Because I don't understand why I couldn't have a baby. I couldn't understand it. And so when I was able to just kind of have that realization, it allowed me to let go of the control and my need to understand, and then allowed me to start to move into a place of acceptance. Right. And I couldn't get there until I could get there. But it was a long, long road, and it was difficult. And I got to a place where I really was okay if that wasn't God's will for me. So I made the decision that I didn't want to try anymore, and I was going to get back on birth control. So I was waiting to start my birth control when my husband and I found out that we were pregnant with my son, Owen. It was like a total miracle thing. And I shared this story in a meeting maybe a year or two ago. And this woman came up to me and she said, isn't it funny how, you know, how lack of control you have, right? Like how powerless we are on both sides of that. Because I had made the decision that I was done trying and that I was okay not having a baby. And then that's when I got pregnant. Like I was planning on starting birth control because I was, again, trying to control the outcome, that I wouldn't get pregnant. I wanted to take the hope out of the equation, right? Because it was so painful and God had a different plan. So it's just so interesting to me how God works or these things show up, right? And people say, oh, well, see, like you let go or blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, that's not why I got pregnant. I don't know why I got pregnant. I don't need to understand it. I just trust that that was what was supposed to happen in that moment. And I'm grateful. That's it. I can't put into trying to understand why things happen anymore or why I deserved it or why that, you know, it's like, it's just life. Like that's just, it's neither good nor bad. It just is. So that was 7 years ago. So a lot has happened between then. Part of why I started crying when I was talking about my stepdad Duke was that 4 days before my son Owen was born, he passed away. And so it was like I've had these circumstances in my life where it's like this very beautiful thing is happening, but also this very, you know, difficult thing. And so my son was born
And I lost my dad at the same time. And that was really hard. You know, because there were so many things that I had wanted to share with him. And that was tough. The first 2 years that I had my son, I was working outside of the home and I was working like 60 hours a week. And we got pregnant with my second son, like a year after Owen turned a year, we got pregnant. It was like crazy. We tried and we got pregnant a month later. So I have these two little boys and I'm working outside of the home and going to meetings and doing all the things. And in the winter of 2019, right before the pandemic, I said to my husband, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I'm working so much. And while we have all this stuff, I'm paying other people to raise our kids. I want to be more present. And so I left the corporate environment and I went to work for a treatment center. And I work for a company called Lime Rock Recovery. And it's an online treatment center. And I never planned on going into treatment. Like, my mom had said, mentioned it to me when I first got sober, that I'd probably do really well working with other alcoholics. Maybe I wanted to be a counselor. And I was like, no. So it's just funny how things work. So today I get to work day in, day out, helping people who are making that phone call for help. And I get to share my experience with them and help them find a solution that works for them, whether that's with treatment or 12 step or other options. So it's a really beneficial and a job that really gives me an opportunity to be of service in my work. And it also allows me to do a lot with my boys. I'm a present mom today. And life today is super busy. It's really full, but I absolutely love it. It's better than I could have ever imagined. When I first got here, I just wanted my brain to stop attacking me. I just wanted to be able to sit in my skin. And today I have that and so much more. So I feel like I'm coming to an end here. So I'm truly grateful to be sober, truly grateful to get to share my experience. And that's all for me.
Thank you, Vanessa. Ness, what a cute nickname. Oh, it's so well done. Well spoken, but so much wisdom for the newcomer and so much for people that have been around for a while. I just loved my mind was constantly attacking me. That hit home. And then life of the party and then crying in the corner. These are things that it's like, yes, yes. And is your husband in the program?
He is. So he's got a beautiful story, but he was 5 years sober when we met and I was, well, he was almost five and I had just turned 10. So he's now, let's see, he just celebrated 18 and I think I'm 24. It's like, when I was younger, I used to not believe people when they didn't remember like how old they were. And I'm like, it's crazy to think that I've been sober where like, I forget sometimes how long I've been sober. 24 years. Yes, I'm 24 and he's 18.
You were talking about when you were young and your thought process being so different than your sister's, that wild impulse, didn't think things through. Do either of your children have that same thought process or not?
Yes, and I hate to even like, because it scares me, right? Like, that's something that I'm actually terrified of, is that addiction runs on both sides of my husband and my family, right? Same with me. It was on both sides. So I know that we're predispositioned for it, if you believe it, that it's genetic, which I think it can be both genetic or
out of nowhere.
Right. But I noticed, so I have my older one, Owen, he is like my younger one. This is an example. We went to Dairy Queen last night and I got them blizzards, little mini blizzards, right? Owen finishes his by the time, like within probably 5 minutes, he's inhaled it. And that's how I was. And Ethan is like, I'm done, and passes it
forward and my husband finished it. That's just how they are. They're different. Owen goes hard with everything that he does. It's like there's no off switch from when he gets up till he goes to bed. He's on. And Ethan is much calmer. He kind of thinks about things a little bit more. So, you know, who knows, right? What ends, hopefully they don't have it. Hopefully that because my husband and I are both sober, maybe they will have tools that we didn't when we were younger. I mean, I don't know why, but I do see more of it with my older one, or at least some of the behaviors that I had as a kid.
And you think back to yourself, that tendency to be, I like how you said impulsive. You don't think things through. You just like jump in. And if some is good, more is better. And you talked about your sugar addiction and that kind of stuff. Is there anything that parents, I'm asking for us to really explore together, because I have one of each too. I have a 25-year-old. I have no idea where he lands, but I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old and one of each, just like your boys. Is there any parenting or anything we can do to explain or walk them through or give them tools on working with those character aspects?
Well, I grew up knowing about AA. I grew up in meetings, and my boys know that we go to meetings, but they don't come to meetings with us. And I get, my mom didn't have an option for a babysitter. We were with all of the other kids on the playground at the meetings and things like that. But I do think that because I knew about AA, I do think that I knew there was a solution a lot younger than a lot of other kids. I think that had I not known about AA, I don't think that I would have ended up sober. You know, I wouldn't have even known what the problem was. I probably would have thought I was depressed or things like that. And so I think that letting our kids know as the, you know, age appropriate and educating them, and also just kind of trusting God, you know, yeah. Like, I think it really comes down to, like, I think about how terrified my mom must have been with me. And I ask her about that. And she says, like, I just trusted God to take care of you, because mm-hmm. she knew that she couldn't control it. And I don't want to be like, I don't want to control them. AA is my blessing today, even though that road to get there was really scary. But I think that because I got sober so young, I do have tools that it took my sister longer to get to, because I had the fourth and the fifth step to process what had happened with our stepdad that faked the cancer. Like, I was able to find that forgiveness, whereas it took my sister, she didn't have that out. Mm. She didn't have drugs and alcohol to help her through that period. She had all the feelings and no solution in that sense. So hers has been like going to counseling and things along those lines, but she didn't do that till she had her son. So like 12 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, that's such a good point. We don't carry that stuff through life when we're sober at 19.
Right.
Or 18. I guess you were 18.
I was 4 months before I turned 19. So almost 19.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I like your mom's advice, or her mm-hmm. practice was just to trust God. Because we all, what is that stupid quote? God doesn't have any grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I, you know what I'm really going to take from your story is your pregnancy thing. And just, because at the end, I was totally, when you were done with your story, then we got pregnant. And I was like those naysayers that was like, see, once you stop trying, it worked.
Yeah.
No. We don't know why. So don't try to, you're still trying to solution and tell me how to make it happen.
It's actually surprising to me at how many women in the program go through, and men, right? Because it really affected my husband too, and it really affected our marriage. Like, we had to go to marriage counseling. We almost did not make it through that. Mm. We were both really struggling through that. And you don't think about that stuff when you get married. Like, hey, what happens if we can't have a baby? What are you willing to do? What are you not willing to do? That was never a conversation that we had had because I just thought we'd get pregnant.
Right.
And then so many people, their intention is good, right? They're trying to hold space for you, but really there's nothing that you can say when a woman's going through that to make it be okay. Like it's really, and it has happened that because of that experience, I've happened to sponsor a handful of women who know my story and have come to me for that experience. And they'll want to hear like, well, how did you guys end up getting pregnant? And I'm like, you may not get pregnant. It might not be your story. And if that's where you're at right now, like that's what we need to be talking about and being honest about. Because I think that a lot of women we don't talk about it in meetings. And it's a really lonely place. And I was so angry with this God that he would not give me a baby. Like that's how it felt. Like God's doing this to me. And I've done everything I'm supposed to do. And I'm not getting what I want. And it was like that Santa Claus God, if I'm good, if I do all the right things, God will give me what I want. And up till that point, I had gotten everything. You know, we're told in AA, do the right thing. And all these beautiful promises happen and they do, right? But then when it's something that you really want and you are truly powerless, there's nothing you can do to will that. It challenges you in another way of, do you really trust God? Do you really believe that God's got your back when it's not your plan? It was hard.
Yeah. Whew. It's, I mean, I just have hip pain and I'm pissed at God.
You know? Like, right. Yeah.
So you being mad about that seems so reasonable. It's like, well, that totally makes sense.
We're not allowed, you know, what does it say? Justified resentment is the dubious luxury of normal men, but for us it is poison.
Yeah.
And I was resentful at God, but I couldn't say that. I couldn't be honest about it because I sponsor all these girls and I have to look a certain type of way and I have to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And who wants to hear that I'm mad at God right now?
Really deeply mad. Like,
yes.
Holding it.
Like, I don't trust you anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm so angry that I'm not talking to him anymore. And it wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't like I was like, oh, I'm going to stop talking to you, God. I'm going to stop praying. It happened kind of like a slow burn, right?
Like it does in marriages, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. Like that I kept asking you for something. You weren't doing it. I was praying. I was doing all of the things. You're not giving me what I want. So I'm going to stop asking you for this because you're not answering me. Mm-hmm. And I just slowly stopped talking. And I would hear people, you know, say in meetings when they came back from a relapse, I've heard people say that they stopped praying. And before this experience, I would think, how could you stop praying? Like, how do you stop talking to God? And then I went through that. And then when I started going through the steps again, Gina asked me to pray with her. And I was so uncomfortable, Tara, mm-hmm. because I had stopped praying. I was so uncomfortable talking to God. And I realized in that moment, that was when I realized that I'd actually stopped praying, that I couldn't remember the last time I had talked to him other than just in like general, you know, the Lord's Prayer and stuff in meetings. And that's not, for me, that's not really praying. That's like community. That's not how I talk to God. I don't pray like that. So I had to get back. I had to create an entirely new relationship. I had to like go through the book like I'd never gone through the. I was more honest that time with all of what I was going through because I was not sharing all of this stuff with anyone. Not even my husband, not my best friend. I wasn't talking about it because it was so painful. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't talk about it. And so going through the steps again saved my life, right? And hindsight's 2020. I know now that had I not gone through the steps, me and my husband would not be together and I would be drinking. That's how close I was.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing all of that. I know that it'll help some listeners.
Thank you.
What is YPAWS, WikiPAWS, Wacky Paws?
It's young people in AA, so YPAA. So if when you get sober young, there are conferences pretty much in, you know, most states that I know of have them. And I'm so grateful that I got sober in a state that had a very strong young people's fellowship, because at 18, the idea of never drinking again, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to smoke cigarettes and drink coffee with old people for the rest of my life in church basements. Like, that does not sound fun. And YPAW, like you typically, like if you call your general service office or your inner group, they typically will know of meetings that there are young people or specifically young people events. And so ICKYPAW is the International Conference of Young People in AA, WACKYPAW is the Western Area Conference, and then ECPAW is the Eastern Area Conference. And then there's little state ones. So like ACCYPAW is the All California Convention, I think is what it stands for. And ASCIPAW, the Arizona State Conference, HICCIPAW, Hawaii. And you go, and it's basically the best way I can describe a YPAW conference is like spring break for sober people. Like It's like Panama City spring break, but it's all sober people. You would have no idea that we're all sober, other than we're running around drinking energy drinks and staying up all night. And it's just like a really good time. And people from all over the world even come to these things. And it's amazing speaker meetings. And you get to go to these different states and stay in these, typically they're in like Marriott's or nice hotels. And it's a bunch of young alcoholics just getting together and learning about each other and having fun. And I'm so grateful that I knew about that, because it made my, you know, early sobriety. It's how I met my husband. Had I not gone to that ICKYPAW, I would not be with my husband.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now or anything that you left out that you'd like to share?
I think, you know, I drink for 5 years and I've been sober for 24. I think that sometimes we have these like, okay, it's like, well, we come in and I never planned on getting sober. And then I got sober and I'm 24 years sober, and I always try to have at least one person in the book, right? I'm always trying to stay in the book for me. I think that for some people, you know, like I'm not the kind of alcoholic that can be away from AA. Right? Like for me, when I'm not active in my program, I get real sick real quick. And so, you know, some people might have that experience where they're able to come into AA and get some of the tools and things like that. And they're able to just, you know, mostly live outside of the rooms. But for me, I'm just not one of those people. I know that for me, AA is something that I hope is a part of my life until I die, you know, at my home group. One of the meetings that I go to every Friday night in Mesa, Arizona, it's called Society Friday Night 5:30. There's a wall with people who have passed that have been a part of that hall since I got sober, and, you know, and my dad's on that wall, you know, like I want to be one of the people on that wall. So I just, the only way that I know that people die sober are people who continue to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like that, those are the people who are on that wall. And I want to end up on that wall.
In a really, really, really long time.
Yes. Not for like a super long time. Yeah.
All right. Final question. What message would you like to leave with the listener, newcomer or otherwise?
What comes to mind for me is that an alcoholic can really look like all sorts of different things, right? Like I was 18, young, Like on the outside, everything still looked good, right? Like even I remember going to young people's meetings and I kind of struggled with it because I really only drank. And when you go to young people's meetings, a lot of people have both drank and done drugs, and that's why they got there so fast, right? But I was really mainly an alcoholic. And so when I would go to these grown-up AA, quote unquote, where it's like normal AA, not specifically young people's, I would be the youngest person in the room at 18. And I would feel like these people are going to not believe that I'm an alcoholic, right? And then I would go to these young people's meetings and I didn't do drugs. So I would feel like I wasn't bad enough. And that's my disease trying to separate me. It's looking for all of the differences and why I don't deserve my seat. I don't care if someone drank for 2 months and that was enough for them, right? The bottom is when we stop digging. And so whatever it is that brings you into Alcoholics Anonymous, grab your seat and hold on. You earn that chair and stay as long as you want.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.